Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Popular Volcanics, the podcast about volcanoes, eruptions, and all things magmatic. This is Dr. Eric Clementi from Denison University and Discover Magazine.
And I am Dr. Janine Krippner, volcanologist with the Smithsonian Institution Global Volcanism Program in Washington, D.C.
So today is the second part of our mini-series related to both my current volcanology class, which is still in the realms of remote learning, and a series on the basics of volcanology. And today we're going to be focusing on two things. One, we're going to talk a little bit about the volcanoes of Europe, and then we'll talk about bits and pieces of how we look for signs that there is unrest at a volcano. And we'll talk about some of the precursory signs and how we monitor for those precursory signs. So that's the plan for today. And the next few weeks, we'll cover other bits and pieces of volcanology. And if you have any suggestions or ideas, feel free to send us a tweet at Pop Volcanics, I'm sorry, on Twitter. And we'll go from there. Anything you want to add, Janine?
I have a short volcanoes video series going, Volcano Moments. It's on YouTube and also on Twitter. So there are a lot of videos there that are covering the basics of so many aspects of volcanism. So they might be a good set of resources to pair with this podcast.
All right. Yes, definitely check those out. There's a bunch of cool ones that have just come out. What are the more recent ones that you have put out for the series?
So I have the scientific response to volcanic ash falls, so covering the huge amount of work that goes into understanding volcanic ash for every event, obsidian lava flows or dragon glass from Game of Thrones, safety considerations when working on active volcanoes, flood basalts or large igneous provinces, volcanism in Alabama, and I did one with you that I don't have up yet that is on crystal ages. So what crystals and rocks can tell us about the ages of when they form.
There we go. We got a lot of things that you can check out if you desire to learn even more about volcanoes. So that's fun. All right. So we'll talk first a little bit about volcanoes of Europe. And just like if you have listened to last week's episode, episode number 6, you'll know that there is a link that you can follow from the Popular Volcanics website, popularvolcanics.weebly.com, where you can download a copy of some slides that go along with what we're going to be talking about. So we'll refer to those as we go along. I think I was supposed to number them last week and I totally forgot, and I'll try to number them this week. There are some slides there that you can take a look at if you want to follow along at home. This is the sort of thing that if you're just a casual volcano fan, if you're teaching a class about geology and volcanology and anything like that, earth science, feel free to use this stuff to enhance the learning experience. So that's what we'll be talking about when I say we're going to move on to the next slide, is our little slide collection that you can take a look at and download it from the blog's website. So with that, I will move to, actually, for people who are curious, the first slide, the introductory slide, has some impressive pictures of lava flows on Etna in Italy. And we'll talk some more about Etna, but that's what those lava flows are, creeping down the side of the volcano and covering over. It looks like that's even some power lines in the foreground from a volcano near people. And that's what sets a lot of these European volcanoes apart from some others. So we have a map of the European area and the location of volcanoes. So when you think of volcanoes in Europe, what do you think of, Janine? Or where do you think of? What countries?
Etna. Sorry, that's not a country. Italy. I definitely think of Etna, Stromboli, and Vesuvius and Campoli Flegrei. Those are the ones that I think of immediately. But of course, we know there's so many more than that.
I guess for me, it's Italy and Greece are the first two that kind of pop into my head, just because we have famous eruptions from volcanoes in both of them. But there are plenty of volcanoes in Turkey. If you get out past the Black Sea, you're getting into some of the volcanoes in, I guess that would be the Caucasus out there. And then there's, of course, the volcanoes of Germany, which most people don't realize. When I say there are volcanoes in Germany, they look at me in a perplexed fashion, and even the volcanoes of central France. So there's a lot more volcanism in Europe. A lot of this is being driven by subduction. So we have the closing of the Mediterranean, and that's generating a lot of the volcanoes that we have in Italy and in Greece. And then we have some places where there is some rifting. So the plates are splitting apart a little bit, and that's what's happening to create some of the volcanoes in Germany, let's say in the Rheingraben, where we have extension, where things are stretching. So there's a lot of different ways that volcanoes are forming in Europe, and they happen to be mostly the ones, like Janine mentioned, that are the most famous are the ones in around Italy, the Aeolian Islands, and then across Greece, because they've produced some pretty significant volcanic eruptions. Now, you had said Etna, so if we move on to the next slide, there is a picture of Etna doing its thing, some lava flows, a map of lava flows from Etna that happened in the early 2000s. You seem to jump straight to Etna. Do you want to say some words about Etna and what you know and think about it?
Yeah, so Etna is one of the most active volcanoes in the world. It's incredible how much this volcano is changing all the time. So if you ever look at a close-up map with the crater names, like there's the new southeast crater, and then there's these different vents, and the vents names basically translate into the new hole or the new hole, because there are new vents and craters forming all the time. You get lava flows, you can get new scoria cones forming within a matter of days. And it's just really incredible to actually go and visit that as well and see how much new earth there is on this volcano.
I think Dr. Boris Behnke likes to say that Etna is the fastest growing mountain on Earth, something to that effect. I know he said something like that to me at one point, because of the fact that all of this volcanism makes the volcano a little bit taller every time. So it's a growing mountain in a volcanic way. And, you know, it's one of these volcanoes too that has such a, its history is so woven into the people and culture of Sicily that, you know, there are towns and settlements on the slopes of the volcano, and they've had to do some interesting things to try to mitigate against the lava flows, which are the big hazard from Etna, where they've used things as simple as highway barriers to try to divert lava flows or drop them into the lava flows to see if they can disrupt them from rolling into cities. But there's been plenty of examples of lava flows rolling into towns on the slopes of the volcano.
And diverting lava flows doesn't work a lot of the time. And in fact, there was an issue on Etna when people tried to divert a lava flow, and the town over realized that they were going to divert it into their town, and then trouble ensued. So that's not always something that is practical or even is going to work.
Yes, you definitely don't want to be trying to divert one disaster into another town to save yours. This is the sort of thing that I guess movies are made of. So that's a good example of it might seem like a good idea to build a wall or a berm to stop that lava flow, but then it might end up in somebody else's yard. So Etna has got some good examples of that if you delve into the literature. So if we move off to the east, we can visit the Bay of Naples. Have you ever been to the Bay? I've never actually been to the Bay of Naples. Have you?
I have. I was at Cities on Volcanoes conference in 2018, and we went up and we walked around the crater of Vesuvius, and the conference itself was in Campi Flegrei. So we went and went to the the observatory there and the old observatory on Vesuvius, and it's really an incredible place.
So can you, having been there, can you kind of describe, so we're talking about Vesuvius now, which is right in the sort of back end of the Bay of Naples, where the city of Naples exists. So can you talk a little bit about how being there, the impression you got of how much Naples, how intimately related Naples and Vesuvius are?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So when you're standing up on the summit of Vesuvius, on one side, you're looking into this enormously steep walled deep crater. And then when you look out towards the sea, you have behind you this kind of old scarp from when the older volcano that was there collapsed. And you see that anything explosive that might happen, like pyroclastic flows or any long lava flows, is going to be channeled down towards the sea. And of course, this place, this volcano is surrounded by people, very densely populated area. So it's scary as a volcanologist who's very interested in keeping people safe. But as we know with these types of volcanoes, there are many more small eruptions, not necessarily those really big ones, like the 79 AD eruption that's very famous, that destroyed Pompeii and Herculaneum and other areas around there.
I'd say, I mean, would you agree with the idea that most volcanologists would see the Bay of Naples area as the most volcanically hazardous location in terms of hazard to people of almost pretty much any volcanic area on Earth?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I mean, when you add in Campi Flegrei, which is just next door, you know, everyone's looking at Vesuvius, but it has a much more dangerous neighbor. But there are a lot of cities built on volcanoes, like Auckland Volcanic Field in New Zealand. So it's definitely one of the scariest locations for an active volcano, not currently erupting as we record this, and very densely populated area.
Yeah, I mean, Vesuvius, the impression I've always had, again, not having been there, is that not only is the city of Naples, it says that, you know, within 30 kilometers of Vesuvius, there's almost 4 million people. And the city of Naples would just be a challenge to get people out of because of the nature of the city itself. So that's one of the reasons that I've always pointed to Vesuvius as a place that if you wanted to see a potentially volcanic, one of the most potentially dangerous volcanic areas, it's going to be the hazard that Vesuvius poses to that all that population of Naples.
Yeah, and an explosive eruption at Vesuvius, like the 79 AD eruption, would be the nightmare scenario. When I was there, looking at how narrow the streets are, I saw an ambulance trying to turn a corner, and it did like a 5 or 6 point turn to try and turn around a corner. So if you think of the response of trying to evacuate an area, you know, you'd hope we'd get a lot of warning, but not so much that people didn't think the volcano was going to do anything and we're getting frustrated.
Yeah, there's a older national, I think it's a National Geographic documentary that's called In the Shadow of Vesuvius that kind of gets at some of these ideas of the challenges of evacuating the people of Naples and Pozzuoli and the area around the Bay of Naples. And if you can find it, it's just worth a watch. And let's see, we can move on to talk about the Campi Flegrei, which again, I think is the one that most people would not even think of around the Bay of Naples, because Vesuvius gets everybody's attention. But the Campi Flegrei is probably an even larger hazard than Vesuvius in many ways because of the fact that it has produced some of the largest explosive eruptions in that part of the world. And it is, there are many signs that magma is clearly sitting beneath the Campi Flegrei, whether it be the hot springs and the hydrothermal vents of the Solfatara, or the fact that the whole floor of the Bay of Naples kind of rises and falls with cycles of volcanic activity, not necessarily eruptions, but at least changes in the system beneath people's feet there in Pozzuoli, which is one of the towns that's around this little bay next to the Bay of Naples, where you look at the satellite image on the slide and you can see all the little volcanic craters that make up the Campi Flegrei.
On top of the garbage truck outside, because I'm working from home during the COVID-19, So the thing that scares me about Camp Le Grey, and first of all, I want to note that these volcanoes are very well monitored by excellent volcanologists. So, you know, it's there are people working on evacuation plans and hazard plans and what might happen. So people are actively working on these volcanoes. But the scary thing about Camp Le Grey is, you know, as we say over and over again, the really large eruptions are more rare. The small eruptions are more frequent around the world. But with this this densely populated area, even a small eruption could be devastating because people are living in it and around these craters. And, of course, if we have an eruption under the water, that could even be more dangerous. So it's a pretty scary situation as well, but hopefully we won't see anything in our lifetimes.
I mean, we talked about Vesuvius. Vesuvius last erupted in 1944, I believe, the 1940s. And Camp Le Grey last erupted in the 1500s, when that was the Monte Nuovo eruption that created a little cone inside the Camp Le Grey. But that was not that, volcanically speaking, that's not that long ago. If it was only about 500 years ago. So they're both very much potentially active volcanoes that are well watched by the INGV in Italy to make sure that we can see when the signs are pointing towards a potential eruption.
Yeah, if you go to the Global Volcanism website for these volcanoes, you can see how many eruptions they've had recently. We have lists under the eruption history tab. So looking at Camp Le Grey, we have the last one in 1538 and then 1198 and then 1600s and everything. So you can actually look at these up to understand how many eruptions there have been.
Yep, and the Camp Le Grey is especially important for the fact that it's had these really massive explosive eruptions like the Campanian Ignimbrite and the what always sounds not as hazardous as I feel like it should, the Neapolitan Yellow Tuff, which sounds more like an ice cream to me than it does a massive explosive eruption. But those occurred, you know, tens of thousands of years ago. But that's, again, pretty recent for a volcano to produce these tens of cubic kilometer explosive eruptions. And that's all coming out of the Camp Le Grey. So it's a pretty important volcanic system. All right. So if we move to the north, we can talk a little bit about the Lagersee in Germany. So during this period in Europe, maybe around 10 or 15,000 years ago, there's a couple of pretty large explosive eruptions that happened. The largest in Germany, which I think is an easy thing to say, was from the Lagersee, which is a caldera that formed kind of in Western Germany near Cologne and Dusseldorf. That is one of the more impressive volcanoes I've visited. So I was able to go and visit the Lagersee when I went to a meeting in Cologne. It has these massive walls of pumice and ash from ashfall and pyroclastic flows. And this eruption that happened about 12,000 years ago spread ash from Scandinavia down into the Mediterranean. And it's when you walk around the lake that fills the caldera now, there's actually still places where you get carbon dioxide bubbling up from the bottom of the lake that likely is being sourced from magma cooling somewhere down underneath the volcano. So yeah, most people don't think that there's this potential for big explosive eruptions from Germany, but 12,000 years ago, again, is not that long ago for a volcano. So there are parts of Europe that are even not usually associated with volcanoes that can have the potential for a volcanic eruption. Have you ever been to the Lagersee?
No, I haven't been there yet.
It is, like I said, you're just driving around. You can see the landscape. If you look at the picture on the slide, the landscape just looks like normal rolling European hills. And then suddenly you realize that you can drive into a quarry and see these massive walls of pumice that are from this eruption. So it's impressive to think that of that sort of eruption happening 12,000 years ago. There's definitely humans living in Europe at the time. So they were impacted by the eruption. There's a monastery, not a monastery. Yes. There is a monastery on the shores of the Lagerse. And you know, some of the stories they talk about are some of the people who lived there hundreds of years ago, setting up little huts to pray in along the shores. And unfortunately, occasionally somebody would die from suffocating from the carbon dioxide being emitted from the lake. So it can still, you know, it's not a huge hazard, but the hazard is there from carbon dioxide being emitted from the lake as well. So that German volcanism is definitely present in Europe today. All right. The last volcano of Europe I wanted to just touch upon real briefly is Santorini in the Aegean near Greece. Do you know much about Santorini?
Well, it's definitely one of these mythical volcanoes and one that I was supposed to be going to in a few months. No, I'm not. Santorini is this volcano that really catches the imagination of people. So some people think that it's tied to the velocity of Atlantis, and it's all to do with this enormous Minoan eruption. So, yeah, it's a pretty famous one.
It's impressive that, there are lots of different both sort of real history and mythologies connected to Santorini on the island of Thera, because it was all part of this Minoan, the area of the Mediterranean at the time was with the Minoan civilization that was mostly based in Crete. And this eruption at Santorini not only produced a giant explosive eruption, but produced a tsunami in the Mediterranean that hit some of the other islands in the eastern part of the ocean there. So we have this massive eruption that was, and now I'm blanking. When was the Minoan eruption? It was 4,000 BC. Is that too long ago? I don't remember now. Maybe I should look it up. Do you recall? Yeah, that's what. So we're looking at the Minoan eruption happening 3,600 years before present. So it was definitely during a time when people were living on Thera, the island that this eruption happened, and people living on other islands in the area that were buried in pumice and ash during this time. So Santorini is just, again, another one of these examples of a massive volcanic eruption that impacted a lot of the early civilizations that were growing around the Mediterranean at the time. Anything else you'd like to add about Santorini?
There have actually been a lot more recent eruptions as well. So as with every other volcano, there are a lot more smaller eruptions than these really big, sometimes mythical events. So there have been more recent events that have happened, domes have grown, or there have been submarine eruptions. So it's definitely an active volcano. It's produced many more smaller recent eruptions, but it's made its mark in history as well.
Yeah, you can kind of see in the image that's included with this that there is a sort of darker splotch in the middle of the hole that was created by the eruption that produced the caldera. And that darker splotch is, in fact, a volcanic island that has grown since the big Minoan eruption. And, you know, Santorini has had a lot of also eruptions that happen nearby that are submarine. And the last known eruption in the area is in about 1950. So again, not that long ago. And there's a lot of people who still live on the island of Santorini. It's a tourist destination. So another place that gets closely watched for volcanic activity, which is a good segue to think about how do we watch these volcanoes? And for those of you playing along at home, you should definitely check out the is it Volcanic Moments or Volcano Moments?
Volcano Moments, but I mess it up all the time.
All right, Volcano Moments that Janine filmed with Dr. Boris Behnke from the Etna Observatory, who talks a lot about how they monitor the volcano Aetna. And if we talk real briefly, you know, when we're talking about volcanic activity, we're trying to look for the signs that something is changing at the volcano. And they need, at that point, when there are signs, volcanologists need to figure out what the signs are actually telling us about what might be changing at the volcano. And sometimes that's not entirely clear. So don't ever fall into the trap of thinking that volcanologists are going to predict when the next volcanic eruption at some volcano is going to happen. You know, we're in the game much like weather forecasters, and or I guess meteorologists would be the better way to put it, of trying to forecast what the probability of events based on the signs of what we see happening at a volcano at a given moment. So sometimes the volcano is doing nothing. So we can say that we're probably seeing nice sunny days of clear skies. But once you start seeing signs that things are changing, we have to start wondering, you know, what's the probability of different events happening? And that's based on a lot of things. That's based on the past activity of the volcano. It's based on what the activity, precursory activity might be. And it might be based on what we see from other volcanoes that are similar. So there's a lot to go into that forecast for potential volcanic activity. So what would you say, what are the things that you think of when you think of changes that we can observe at a volcano as it's becoming restless?
So first and foremost is seismicity, which is incredibly complicated and technical, and you have to be a geophysicist to really understand the signals. And then I think gas, so the different types and amounts of gas that is released and how that changes through time. Deformation, so if you have fluids or magma that is moving into the edifice or the volcano, actually physically changing the shape of it on the order of millimeters to centimeters, sometimes meters as well. We have remote sensing, so we can look at the thermal changes, the chemistry of the fluids coming out of the volcano, so if you have any hot springs. Infrasound is a great one that's looking at the air waves, or like the seismicity, but instead of going through the earth, it's going through the air. And then actually visual, actually, what does the volcano look like? Is it, are the fumaroles more vigorous? Is it actually erupting? So it's a huge, like, it's a huge team effort for a volcano observatory to be monitoring a volcano. It takes all of these different expertise and knowing what the caveats are. So you can easily look at a weather quarter, which we'll explain in a bit, online and say, well, everything's increasing, it's going to blow. But really the reality is that you have to know all the different options of what these things might mean and start to narrow that down into what's happening.
Yeah, and I mean, the forecasts that we can make when a volcano is becoming restless, you know, it's tricky because volcanoes aren't necessarily going to progress in a linear fashion. They might, there's the famous, what's the famous line in the Pinatubo documentary that I think it's John Gewirt says, is that things went nonlinear, meaning that the activity ramped up dramatically. Figuring out both the what and the when and the how big are all things that volcanologists monitoring a volcano are trying to figure out. But getting all of those is very difficult because there's just so many things that are not privy to going on inside the volcano, possibly.
Right. When you're looking at these monitoring signals that we're getting, we're monitoring magma that is moving kilometers to tens of kilometers below the surface. We can't see it. There's this big misconception that we can use geophysical tools to look at the magma, but we can't. Even just mapping where a magma system might be, like using geophysical tools, the lavas that make up the volcano make that extremely difficult. But in saying that, this can save tens of thousands of lives, like the Pinatubo event did. They evacuated people in time and saved so many lives, and this really does work. You just have to have the right experts, the right equipment, and knowing what the volcano normally does when it's not erupting really helps as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is much like the parallels we can draw to our current biological hazards that are going on in the world today. These are not things that are entire enormous surprises to the communities that study them. So both listening to and following the instructions of experts who know something about volcanoes or pandemics or whatever is going to save lives. And the result might not be pleasant in the short term if it causes, you know, economic or lifestyle disruptions, but it is saving lives from the greater disasters that can happen. And that even if you might, even if the experts might not be able to get the exact date of when, let's say, the peak of infections or the eruption itself happens, if people can be put out of harm's way, that's the key. And that is the important thing to remember when we're dealing with these active ongoing crises, is that these are not things that can be predicted to the second. And it is better to be safe than sorry, I guess, is the best way of putting it. So listen to the experts and heed their warnings when they think something is going to be going sideways soon.
Absolutely. You know, so as someone who specializes in pyroclastic flows or explosive eruptions, you know, that I've read about what happens to people during eruptions when they get caught in it, and it's horrific. And you can go back to one of our previous podcasts to hear me say the word horrific 10,000 times, but it truly is. It's gut wrenching. It's horrible. Absolutely horrible. So, you know, volcanoes are a very, very natural part of life on this planet, and we have to respect that and learn how to live with it and evacuate, let them do their thing. There's no way of stopping it, and then move back and try to put our lives back together. So it's incredibly important to understand that volcanologists and observatories are there to save lives and to help people.
Let's think a little bit about what are the ways that the volcanologists can monitor these things. The first one you mentioned was seismicity, and that's probably, I don't want to, it is probably the most important tool these days for at least understanding when unrest is going to, when a volcano is moving back into a state of unrest. You know, seismicity, you're taking a area of rock and changing the pressure that it's feeling when magma's rising, when gases are rising with the magma, and it's going to cause changes in that stress that the rock is feeling, and that's going to generate earthquakes. So there's a whole bunch of different, we don't just examine the fact that earthquakes are happening, but there's a lot of different ways that the seismicity, the way the earth is shaking, the location that the earthquakes are happening, the frequency that they're happening, that all get combined to tell us different bits of the story of what's happening underneath the volcano. So when we think about seismicity, what I have on this slide is a plot that has just a sequence of earthquakes that were happening. And the way that most of the way that we think about earthquakes at volcanoes is that we are looking at the location, so a spot on Earth and then a depth. And combining those three things underneath a volcano, we can start to determine whether earthquakes might be getting shallower. That might imply that the volcano, the magma is rising. Might be changing locations. That gives us a sense of maybe where the eruption could happen. And then the number and frequency and location of the earthquakes will change, especially once the volcano starts erupting and we can get a sense of maybe how much magma is being fed in. But to do that, you need a bunch of seismometers. One seismometer isn't going to do it for you. You need to probably have at least three, if not five, to really be able to get the full advantage of location and depth of earthquakes at a volcano. And there are many volcanoes that have a vast network of seismometers on them. And there are some volcanoes that might only have one. And that the idea would be to deploy seismometers quickly if that one seismometer starts to pick up more earthquakes at that volcano. You know, we can talk a little bit about the styles of earthquakes that happen at volcanoes. They're not all the same. Some of the volcanic earthquakes are happening because you have rock being shattered as magma moves. Sometimes you have earthquakes happening because you have the actual fluid motion of a volcanic eruption, fluid motion of the magma as it moves in underneath the volcano. You have some signal that represents the tremor from the seismic noise that's produced by magma and bubbles in that magma as it rises up underneath the volcano. And we have to look at the shape of the seismic signal to tell these different things apart. So on one of the slides, on slide number 10, there are a series of pictures that show this different types of seismicity at volcanoes. The VT are these rock shattering earthquakes caused by changes in pressure. The volcanic tremor is the noise created by magma moving or bubbles in the conduit. The LP events are these long period earthquakes that are happening as we have fluid motion of magma in the crust. And then you can have combined events that are both shattering the rock and the fluid motion of magma moving through the earth. So seismometers record this information, and then geophysicists and seismologists will look at the data to get at what kinds of earthquakes are happening, which then give us the clue of what might be going on underneath the volcano.
Yeah, this is incredibly complicated stuff. Have you ever gone to seismicity or seismology conference talks?
I have gone to very few.
I've gone to quite a few trying to understand this, and I tell you, as an expert in volcanology, it is so hard to understand what they are talking about because this is such a specialized area of geophysics, and I have so much respect. I mean, for every area of volcanology, it's all that way, but the seismicity, we are really translating this so that everyone can understand it, but it is enormously complicated. So we can look at these different events telling us different types of magma movement, but to even tease these out when you could be having hundreds or thousands of earthquakes in a day is really hard. It's hard stuff. So yeah, this is a great area of science and we're learning more all the time.
And these are, like, again, I think you're right to point out that they're, when you're looking at a seismic trace, it's not just discrete events, but necessarily it might be different earthquakes and different types of shaking happening at the same time. So we have volcanic tremor that is being superimposed on top of the VT, the volcano tectonic earthquakes caused by the shattering of rocks. So trying to deconvolute the seismic signal is an impressive feat. And what we're trying to do a lot of the times is look at how we can predict maybe look at if ways to forecast when an eruption might be happening. There are these things that are called the failure forecast method or model, where you can examine the stress and strain being put, or the stress being put on a volcanic system, and its response to that, and make some, you can use the patterns of strain being felt to make some inferences about when you think the next blast might happen. And there's some good examples from the Mount St. Helens eruptions in the 1980s where people use this fairly effectively. USGS geologists use this fairly effectively to be able to say when the next explosive event might happen at the volcano, as we had different changing stress fields at the volcano it's impressive. I wouldn't even know where to start to try to figure some of these things out, because we look at volcanic activity, I'm sorry, earthquake activity in a lot of different ways. Here again, if we move on to slide 12, again, more examples of the types of earthquakes. You can have earthquakes that are producing combinations. So figuring out, when you look at then the monitoring, you have a series of seismometers set up all across a volcano. So this is example on slide 13 of Mount Etna, where there are dozens of seismometers on the volcano. And you can then use those seismometers to track the depth and location, the where earthquakes are happening, to then fit to some of these models to try to figure out what might the future hold. We can look at a whole bunch of different styles of seismic data. One of them, which is called RSAM, looks at the average seismic amplitude over some period of time. So you're trying to look at more or less how much, what's the aggregate amount of earthquake activity during some sequence of time. Usually it's a fairly short period of time, but you're looking at trying to understand how much seismic activity is happening. And then we have another method that they call SSAM, so for seismic spectral amplitude measurements, where you are trying to figure out the difference between types of seismic noise, types of different seismic activity. So sometimes you get shaking because of volcanic activity and magma, but then sometimes you have shaking because of other stuff. Can you think of some other stuff that causes shaking at volcanoes?
Transport, so cars, sometimes grizzly bears are causing noise at a volcano. Wind is a really, really big one as well. Distant tectonic earthquakes or regional earthquakes can cause noise. Even the ocean can cause noise. Like anything that sends any kind of vibration through the earth, no matter how small, if it's close enough, it will be picked up. And that's a huge job for geophysicists, and they have programs that help with this, is to cut out the noise, the non-volcanic signals. So when you look at some of these plots online, they can look like the volcano is really ramping up and it's exploding, but really there's a flood nearby. So knowing the local area is really important. During Argonne, when it was ramping up towards an eruption, people were noticing that activity was stronger during the day, and people were trying to come up with all of these different things, like, is it related to the cycle of the moon? But in reality, there was a mine nearby. So there were explosions and things happening at this mine that were being picked up. And so then we had this daily cycle. So there are a lot of things that seismologists have to contend with to get the actual real data out of these signals.
Yeah. So in the slide 15 here with the SSAM data, there's a couple examples of spectral analysis from New Zealand. And what a seismologist will have to do is look at the different spectra of the seismic waves, the frequency, and determine which of these are being caused by potential volcanic precursors, and which ones are just being caused by, like Janine said, a really windy day at Nuruhui or something. This is where it gets dangerous, as people who are less versed in this analysis try to interpret this. I never even dipped my toe into trying to interpret webcorders or seismic information online, because I don't have the expertise to do it. I leave that to the experts. So you always want to be careful with people trying to interpret this information, because it can be easily misinterpreted in ways that are not helpful for understanding the hazards that are going on.
Absolutely. I second that. I would never look at a seismogram and try to figure out what was going on. Like, you can look at it and get an idea, matching it with what the experts are saying, but on its own, I would never. Like, this is so far beyond my expertise. So anyone claiming that they know what's happening based on this is they're sorely mistaken. This is one of those cases where the more you know, the more you don't know, the more you know that you don't know.
In terms of the ways that seismologists are going to interpret this data, you know, I've already talked a little bit about things like figuring out what we call the hypocenter of the earthquake, its location and depth. We can look at things like earthquake swarms. So on slide 17 is an example of what we call a webiquarter trace. So you have these great resources online where you can actually see close to real-time data of earthquakes coming into seismometers. And seismic swarms are these periods when there's a lot of earthquakes. They might not necessarily be leading to an eruption, but they are periods when maybe magma is moving or even hydrothermal fluids, hot fluids in the volcano are moving. And you get this sequence of lots of earthquakes. Many of them might be not even noticeable if you're standing there. They might be so small that only the seismometer detects them. But you get a whole bunch of them in rapid succession over maybe hours or days or weeks that get people's attention. So on slide 17 here, we have a seismic swarm during the precursory time leading up to the eruption of Afialiokol. Actually, this was afterwards. Is this actually, no, I'm wrong. This is not Afialiokol data. This is from one of the other Icelandic volcanoes nearby, but seismic swarms that happen at Katla, I believe. That didn't lead to any sort of eruption, but are events that show that the system is still active. So it gets tricky because volcanoes can be restless without actually leading to an eruption.
Yeah, that's a good point. We can get magma intrusion, so magma actually rising up into the shallower surface, near the surface of the Earth, and then they can stop. So that's really when it comes to knowing what all the different scenarios that might happen and having all the different monitoring types and using all of that together to understand what might happen.
So yeah, you're looking at seismic swarms. And if we move on to the next slide, you're looking at the types of earthquakes that the seismometers are tracing. And, you know, we move on from there. We have earthquakes that are generated by the actual eruption. So we have these earthquakes that are generated potentially from the magma moving, but there's lots of other ways that seismic events can happen at a volcano. So the actual eruption itself can cause part of the volcano to, let's say, collapse maybe, or the force of the magma coming out of the ground can produce earthquakes and seismicity themselves. We have, like I mentioned before, this volcanic tremor that happens. So on slide 20, you can see an example of some of the volcanic tremor on these webiquarters that represents magma moving or gas bubbles moving. But if you take a look at slide 21, there's just all these other ways that you can generate noise. You can have wind, strong wind. There's this great example from on the bottom of this slide from Rupehu, where you have chairlift noise. Because what do we know? What's interesting about Ruapehu being an active volcano?
There are two major ski fields on Ruapehu. So we have one on the north side and one on the south side. And there are people that come all from all around the world to actively ski and snowboard on them. So Whakapapa is the one on the north side, and that's actually Aloha Path too. So they do active drills to make sure people know what to do. And the sirens go off saying there is a laha coming, because you can have these explosive events, but you can also have minor events that eject the crater lake water that can have them going down the side too. So it's a pretty hazardous place, but again, very well monitored, and there are a lot of plans in place to keep people safe.
Have you ever seen the documentary that they show at the ski area from the eruptions of Ruapehu in the 1990s?
Honestly, I have seen so many videos of those eruptions that I'm not sure which one you're talking about, but I've probably seen it, yes.
I have shown it in some of my classes before, because it has this great scene where they have the press person from one of the ski areas talking about how the ash that day from the eruption was blowing the other direction. So they had great conditions for skiing on their side of the volcano. And that's one of these things where it's like, huh, that's an interesting sort of vaguely cavalier attitude to have about skiing during the volcano actually actively producing ash. But You know, that's, again, this weird balance between hazard and economics that we are finding ourselves in even today. So I think it's called Witness to an Eruption, and it's well worth finding if you can find it. It's hard to find, I think, because I think I've only seen it in New Zealand, but it's a interesting documentary on these eruptions from Ruapehu. All right. So some other ways that we can get earthquakes at volcanoes, or maybe not earthquakes, but seismicity, shaking of the ground, pyroclastic flows, they can generate seismic signals. So when you have pyroclastic flows moving down the volcano, it's hot ash, debris, and chunks of the volcano moving down its slopes. So you can see the signal of that in your seismic stations, both by the fact that sometimes the seismic stations just get taken out by the pyroclastic flows, and sometimes they will record the, what we'd say, the Doppler shift as the pyroclastic flow moves by, and you can use that to sort of monitor pyroclastic flow activity when you don't want to be too close to the volcano.
You never want to be too close when there's a pyroclastic flow.
Yeah. You know, lahars, the same thing, the mud flows. I believe the picture that I have on slide 23 here is in fact a mud flow from Ruapehu.
Yep, 2007.
All right. You probably know that better than I do, but it is a nice picture.
That.
Oh, cool. But lahars, again, there's a specific type of shaking that happens that are coming from lahar flows. So that's one of the ways that people look for the signal of a lahar happening on a volcano, is you have seismometers that can record this type of certain frequencies that suggest that it's a mud flow that's happening. So these are all different ways that you can get earthquakes to, or not earth shaking to happen at a volcano. So there's a lot of different things that a seismologist will have to look at to understand, is this magma motion? Is this a pyroclastic flow? Is this a lahar? What is this telling us about the changes at the volcanic system? And this picture on slide 24, this graph, which is, I believe, out of the Lockwood and Hazlitt textbook, shows how earthquake activity, seismic activity, can change during the course of an eruption. So, you know, you might have a certain type of earthquake that peaks at a certain point, and then it changes, the style of earthquake and seismicity changes as different things are producing the seismic activity. So there's a lot of different ways that you can interpret, a lot of things you have to interpret as the volcano is heading towards an eruption. What are some of the other things that you would think of for precursory activity? You said sometimes we actually get explosions before the main event.
Yeah, so we can have these throat clearing events or phreatic events where you have your heat source, the magma is rising up towards the surface, and water that's already in the volcano and any liquids, fluids coming out of the magma itself are rising up. That can be turned to steam because of the immense heat, that can be trapped and build pressure and then explode. So that happened actually this time 40 years ago. That was happening at Mount St. Helens before the big event.
Yeah, so this is, we talked a little bit about this in the last podcast about how we want to look at these precursory explosions and try to understand whether the ash that's being produced has what we call that juvenile component, that new magma, or if it's just material that's at the vent that was shattered because the water flashing to steam and causing the explosion. So you can have these phreatic explosions, steam-driven events that might be the precursory signs of something else, or they just might happen and then nothing follows up. So, you know, some of the more famous ones, because of the amount of sadly, the amount of death that occurred, were like the phreatic explosions at something like Ontake in Japan, where that did not lead to more eruptions at the volcano. It wasn't a precursory sign, but it was an explosion driven by a steam at the volcano, if I understand it correctly.
Yeah, that's what I got from that too. That was a gut-wrenching, heartbreaking event.
Yeah, there's, I think it was about 40 people who perished because it was a popular hiking destination. Sometimes these precursory events can happen unexpectedly because there's not, for unlike a magma-driven eruption, a steam-driven eruption, there usually aren't a lot of seismic signals that lead up to that event. So they are especially hazardous for volcanoes that are potentially active and popular destinations for people to visit. But they can also be these precursory explosions that give us a sign that things are heating up at the volcano, leading to more activity down the road. It might be days, it might be weeks, it might be months down the road, but they can be these events that will show us that things are getting heated up again at the volcano. All right. So what else do we got? We got deformation. Volcanoes can definitely change shape as magma rises in into the volcano, or even as magma might be making its way, moving around laterally underneath a volcano. And also it can change shape because you have water, hot hydrothermal fluids and gases moving around underneath a volcano. So the crust itself can change shape. And I think you were saying that deformation, we can have changes that are sort of in the millimeter scale, but all the way up into sort of meters of change based on what the magma's doing.
Yeah. So in Mount St. Helens, when you had the magma rising up into the volcano itself, the north face of the volcano was moving at an alarming rate up to meters per day. So when you have that magma that's moving all the way up into that surface, you know, there's no hole for the magma to move into. It's wedging its way through rock, breaking rock as it goes, and that can force the land out. But when we have, on this slide here, Camp Lake Legree, one of the more recent crises where there was inflation is thought to be just fluids, just water. So again, you can never just use one monitoring tool to understand what's going on.
The way that we look at deformation, some of it is just visual. Not St. Helens in 1980. After a while, you could just look at the volcano and see that it was deforming. But a lot of the times, it's a lot more subtle than that. So you have to, you know, originally you do things by doing leveling on the land. And maybe look at things like lake surfaces on volcanoes, triangulation, lots of sort of ways to examine the changing surface using methods that we have used for centuries now to understand the elevation of the land surface. These days, thankfully, there are some other ways to do it as well using satellite data. So INSAR, looking at taking profiles of the land surface over periods of time and comparing them to see where the differences lie and trying to understand whether the land surface is rising or falling is another great way to look at deformation at volcanic areas. So this image on slide 26 is INSAR data for the area of the Bay of Naples. And you can see there the uplift around the Camp Lake Flegre down on the left side of the image is saying that there's some of this area that's moving half a centimeter per month upwards. And then there's some areas around Vesuvius that are actually moving downward a few tenths of centimeters per month. So we can look at both volcanoes that are inflating and deflating. And the biggest thing right now is that seeing that we can now do this to so many volcanoes, just understanding how much volcanoes do this during periods of repose between eruptions, how restless. We talk about Yellowstone being a restless caldera because it has this inflation and deflation that can happen. A lot of volcanoes seem to show that sort of pattern even between eruptions.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm the warning voice of these podcasts. This is also incredibly complicated. So I have been trained in how to do this, and it's hard. You have to get images that are close enough together that you can get what we call coherence. So the images have to be able to match each other. And this can change with vegetation, or wetting the soil can make things difficult, or if you have any other kind of land movement around the area, like earthquakes. So there's a huge amount of processing that has to go into this, and even knowing what the atmosphere is at that location, is it a really humid environment that can add to these things? And all of these things have to be understood and filtered out before you can get to this pretty clear image. So it's hugely complicated, but it's also an incredibly amazing tool that we can use to monitor volcanoes and look at earthquake, seismic earthquake events too.
You know, we can look at deformation at specific locations, and, you know, different parts of the volcano might see rising and falling. So this is some data on slide 27 from Iceland again. And depending on where you are relative to the volcano, you might see changes of inflation and deflation depending on where magma might be moving. So this is coming from Afialiokol, and different GPS stations, which now, I guess that's the other way I should have mentioned that we can measure deformation these days, is GPS, that you can carefully monitor small changes in the sort of scale of millimeters at a volcano. And as the land surface changes, as magma's rising, we can see how different areas of the volcano are changing in concert based on what might be happening underneath it. And then another thing that they kind of do in Iceland that's related is this idea of that even the ground surface, the subsurface will feel strain. So we have this method that people use, especially in Iceland, of borehole strain. So you put a strain meter in a hole in the ground and look for changes in what that strain meter might be feeling in the ground, which is related to deformation as well. So they've been able to use this fairly effectively. They found that you can link it to potential eruptions. Hecla eruption in 2000, was it the strain, borehole strain, could be correlated with the eruption quite effectively. So these are just some other ways that we can look at this, the deformation of the ground, to get at potential activity at a volcano. All right. Almost there. Gases, volcanic gases. What do we like to look at for volcanic gases?
So it depends on how shallow the magma is. When the magma is much more deep, we can look at carbon dioxide, or if it's shallow too, depending on the magma type. Or we can look at different kinds of sulfur gases as well. And again, this is way beyond my level of expertise, and it's hugely complicated. But looking at the types of gases, the ratios of the types of gases, and how that changes through time is a really great way of looking at how much magma there might be and how close to the surface it might be as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways that you can interpret gas monitoring data, and a lot of ways that it can be challenging to interpret it. I know at Pinatubo, one of the more important observations is the fact that the sulfur dioxide that was being emitted was being scrubbed out by water that was present. So that there, maybe, you know, carbon dioxide might was another way that you could look at the emissions being produced from the magma rising.
Yeah, and the same thing happened in Mount St. Helens too. They were expecting gases because, magma was rising, but it wasn't. So when you have those wet volcanoes that have a lot of water within the system, that can absorb these gases, and then you're not going to see them.
Yep, so you have to monitor multiple gases, like carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, all these sorts of things, and try to, again, look at how they all behave in concert. So getting at that, getting at what Janine had mentioned, the idea of maybe you could determine the amount of magma that's rising and the depth that magma is sitting. One important thing to note that I always have to note in these situations is that we talk about volcanoes emitting carbon dioxide. No, they're not the ones that are emitting all the carbon dioxide that's causing global climate change. End statement. And we can move on from that. So don't jump to that conclusion. But, you know, even a lot of the times the way we measure these things is that you can use different types of oh my God, my brain is failing me. How would we classify the types of instruments that we measure gases at volcanoes?
There are CoSpec, you can use different kinds of materials, instruments you can put on airplanes, or you can look from the ground up through the plume. You can also use satellite data. So trophony is a really great one to look at sulfur dioxide. You can try and measure it in situ. So you can send drones through to collect the gas. And you can also use instruments to collect gas at fumaroles within the crater. But that's clearly a much more dangerous way to look at gas species too.
Yeah, so there are ways that we can measure gas emissions without having to be right at the place where the gases are coming out, I think is an important point that I was stumbling awkwardly towards trying to make there.
Got you back.
Yeah. You know, and we can also, you know, some other sort of physical chemical parameters that people look at are like the ground temperature. I know you mentioned things like looking at heat measurements from satellite observations. We can look at the pH of soils and soil carbon dioxide. There's lots of different information that can be taken to give us some sense of changing chemistry at these volcanoes as maybe magma is rising, because magma, it's chock full of gases that come out of solution as the magma rises, and it can emit a lot of them as new magma is rising up. And that's what we want to look for, is what is that signal that we can find for changing emissions? Because some volcanoes, let's say the picture on slide 29 is just the former summit of Kilauea, and you have constant gas emissions there, that then as new magma comes in, it might change, which gives us a clue that something is happening at the volcano if suddenly we have a lot more sulfur dioxide, let's say, being emitted.
I was going to say, if you think of magma like a bottle of Coke, before you open the bottle, you can't see the gas. It's just liquid. And that's because it's put into the bottle, put under pressure, so the gas is within the liquid. It's not actually a gas phase. But once you take the cap off, you've released the pressure. There's no longer that pressure inside the bottle. That gas can start to come out. Same thing with volcanoes, just very, very simplified. So if you shake that bottle up and then take the cap off, you've agitated everything. The gas is coming out very quickly, forming bubbles very rapidly that have been violently exploding to create that foam coming out of the bottle. That's a good analogy for an eruption. So a gas is really a super important driver for eruptions. And when that starts to come out, we can measure that.
When we're looking at the what's going on at these volcanoes, we're really trying to get at how much of that new material is showing up underneath the volcano. So, you know, gases are going to be important. We can also look at things like crater lakes, where we have how the volcano is impacting bodies of water. So sometimes you're going to have changes in the pH of a crater lake or the temperature of a crater lake, or things like that that we can monitor closely. So they do this at Ruapehu. They do this at Yellowstone. They do this at, to some degree, I think they're doing this at Taal in the Philippines. And even the water table around a volcano can change as new magma is rising up. So you might have measurements of changes in the level of water in wells in the sort of scale of maybe days to even just minutes before an eruption, that are all being impacted by the changes in the sort of stress and temperature around a volcano when magma's coming in. So there's a whole suite of stuff we can examine that can affect our interpretation of what that volcano is going to be doing in the future. I think we've kind of come to the last slide. Do you have anything you want to add as we sort of wrap up thinking about precursory things and signs of eruption?
I think just that, you know, we really emphasize the unknown or the uncertainty with all of these methods, but I want to emphasize that there are dozens of scientists that are behind every single one of these methods around the world. This is a global effort to understand every single one of these tiny techniques and then how to put them together as well. So how does seismicity correlate with gas or deformation? So there's a lot we do know. There's a lot we don't, and we're still working around the world to figure that out. But this stuff can really save lives. As we saw the Kilauea 2018 eruption, a well-understood, a well-known volcano, USGS, or the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, started giving out alerts like, we think this might happen within the next week, and that was spot on. So it's a great science. Sometimes it's more of an art form, but this stuff really does save lives, and it's incredible what we can forecast with eruptive events.
All right. Well, I think that sort of wraps us up for this week's Popular Volcanics. Next week, I believe we'll be talking about large eruptions, caldera-forming eruptions, so that'll be exciting. But yes, feel free to send us comments or questions that we can address in future episodes. And we will continue to provide some of these podcasts to keep you entertained and educated during our time of individual existence. So yeah, with that, I will let Janine say farewell.
Yeah, I just want to say I hope you're okay, everyone out there. I know this is a really tough time with COVID-19, and I hope that these resources are helping you, whether you're a parent, a student, a teacher, or just someone interested. I hope you're okay. Good luck, all the best. My heart is with you all, and thank you so much for tuning in.
Yes, I will. Reiterate what Janine said. Hope everyone is doing as best as they can right now. And much like many crises that have happened in the past, I think we should hopefully make it through this one as well.